moan. Looking uncomfortable, Anson said, "Speaking of Foray, just who the hell is Killifer working for?"
"What do you mean?" Edith asked.
"You don't think he went all the way out to Kiribati and murdered their chief of state all on his own, do you? Who's pulling his strings?"
"The police will find out when they catch him," Edith said.
Anson shook her head.
"He's already left Kiribati. Never went back to his hotel. Chartered a plane and took off at first light."
"Interpol will find him," Edith said confidently. Anson was not so certain.
"Interpol works for the UN now, doesn't it? Besides, what evidence do they have that he murdered Bonai?"
"An eyewitness," Doug said from his bunk.
"In virtual reality," Anson countered. "I wonder if Interpol or anybody else is going to take that seriously."
Sinking back on his pillows, Doug admitted, "You're probably right. The Kiribati police certainly took their sweet time getting out to the islet to find her body." Edith looked intrigued.
"An eyewitness in VR. That's a hell of a story."
"They won't accept my testimony," Doug said weakly. "I won't even be able to testify against him. It's totally useless. I'm totally useless." Edith sat on the edge of the bunk.
"Don't think that for a minute, Doug. We'll get him. You'll see."
Doug closed his eyes. "Let me sleep for a while. I need to sleep." "The tranquilizers are hitting him," the medic said.
"About time," said Anson. "Come on, let him get some rest," Edith said, shooing them out of the bedroom.
The others left, all except Gordette. "I'll wait outside," he said to Edith. "If you need to go someplace, I'll stay with him." Day 42. Edith worked through the night at the computer in Doug's living room, splicing together a coherent story about the rape and murder of a national leader that was witnessed by a man from 400,000 kilometers away. She called down to Global News headquarters in Atlanta a dozen times, rousting researchers and fact-checkers until she had the whole thing pieced together. Once she squirted the basic bits through to Atlanta, she looked in on Doug, who was still asleep in his bunk. Afraid of disturbing him, she took the sling chair in the living room and leaned back to catch a few winks. Her sleep was interrupted almost immediately by the phone chime. It was Manny, her programming chief in Atlanta, bouncing in his chair with excitement.
"Edie, cheese, this is terrific. The assassination on Tarawa was witnessed by a guy on the moon. Absolutely fantastic."
"And it's our exclusive," Edith pointed out.
Manny hadn't stopped talking.
"Legal says we can't name the killer. Can't make any accusations until the guy's arrested and charged, but jeez, the story's tremendous."
Edith smiled at the screen, but for the first time in her career, she realized that behind the story she was filing, there were human beings in pain. A dead woman. Doug, sick with frustration and responsibilities that no one could take off his shoulders. And a murderer somewhere on Earth who would probably never be arrested, let alone brought to justice.
"Yeah," she said wearily to her boss.
"Tremendous is the word for it, all right."
Manny eyed her questioningly. "You don't look so hot, kid."
"I'm kind of tired," she admitted.
"Pull yourself together. We missed the evening news slot, but the suits upstairs want your personal report in the system in time for our affiliate's 11 o'clock.
Edith had been on the moon long enough to make a quick mental calculation. She had a little less than 3 hours to show up at Moonbase's studio looking bright and perky for a live broadcast.
"Okay," she said.
"Let me get a little nap."
"And some makeup."
"Yeah, sure," she said,
knowing that it might be a problem. She had been borrowing makeup from the supply that Joanna Brudnoy had left behind, but she had always scrupulously asked Doug's permission to raid his mother's quarters. Now Doug was sleeping, tranquilized, and she didn't want to wake him. She stretched out again on the sling chair, this time using the desk chair to rest her feet upon. She set her wristwatch's alarm for 1 hour. Maybe Doug'll be awake by then, she thought. She fell asleep almost at once, a trick she had learned years ago. News reporters had to grab their sleep when they could, like soldiers. The wrist alarm beeped softly. Edith woke as instantly as she had gone to sleep, alert and feeling refreshed. She tiptoed to the partition and looked in on Doug. He was tossing restlessly, the sheet twisted around his legs. Edith went in and straightened the sheet, kissed him lightly on the forehead, then tiptoed out again. I'll have to go over to Mrs. Brudenoy's place without asking him, she thought. Yet she hesitated, not wanting to leave Doug alone. If he wakes up, I ought to be here, or somebody ought to be here at least. Who to call? Then she remembered that Bam Gordet had offered to watch Doug. The man acted like a bodyguard anyway, Edith told herself. She phoned him, but there was no answer at his quarters. It's past 2 in the morning, she saw, glancing at the digital clock set next to the computer screen. He couldn't be still waiting out in the corridor, could he? She pushed the door open, and Gordet was sitting on the floor, his back against the opposite wall, his eyes wide open and focused squarely on her. "You've been out here all night?" Edith asked, incredulous. Getting to his feet, Gordet nodded. "I can sleep any place," he said, by way of explanation. Swiftly, almost whispering, Edith told him that she had to go to the studio and do a live broadcast. Gordet nodded solemnly. "I'll take care of Doug."
"Wonderful," said Edith,
suppressing an urge to kiss him on the cheek. Gordet did not seem like the kind of man to play the usual media kissy-face ritual. Gordet watched her hurry down the corridor. Silently, he slid the door shut and walked to the partition that separated the two sections of Doug Savinger's quarters. Doug lay on his back, his eyelids flickering, his fists clenched. "Not while he's asleep," Gordet told himself, fingering the obsidian blade in his coverall pocket. "That wouldn't be right. You don't slaughter a sleeping victim." The blade had drunk many victims' blood centuries ago. Gordet had found it in a crumbling Mayan temple deep in the jungle during the Yucatan Uprising. A ceremonial killing knife, the anthropologist attached to his unit had told him, used for slicing open the chest and taking out the still-beating heart. The anthropologist had been assigned to the army to help win the hearts and minds of the rebellious Yucatan villagers. Gordet had been a sniper then, sighting his victims in his telescopic sights and firing virus-soaked flechettes into their unsuspecting flesh. It felt like a mosquito bite, and the victim died of fever within 2 days. When all went well, the victim infected his entire village before he died. The anthropologist never won the villagers' hearts and minds. He was killed in a vicious ambush. By the time Gordet and the survivors among his unit were flown out of the jungle, there were almost no villagers left alive. Gordet sat calmly next to Doug's bunk and willed him to awake. "It's time," he said silently to his victim. "Death has waited long enough." Doug opened his eyes. He blinked, once, twice. "Bam," he said. Gordet nodded solemnly. "Miss Elgin had to go to the studio to do a live broadcast." "Oh." Doug made a weak grin. "And you're babysitting me, if that's what you want to call it." Without lifting his head from the pillow, Doug asked, "So how's it going?" "How's what going?" "Your investigation. The sabotage of my suit." "Oh, that." Gordet took the obsidian blade from his pocket. Its curved side fit into the palm of his hand perfectly, as if it had been made all those centuries ago expressly for him. "Well?" Doug asked. "That's not important now," said Gordet. "What do you mean, not important?" "You're defeated, Doug. You know that, don't you?" Doug's eyes had no fire in them, no zest. He merely stared at Gordet blankly. "Moon base is lost. You can't save it. You couldn't even help Miss Bonai. You watched her being raped and murdered and couldn't do a thing about it." Doug opened his mouth, but no words came out. He nodded dumbly. "Everything you want has been taken away from you," Gordet said, speaking slowly, sonorously, like a priest at a sacrificial altar. "Even your life." So swiftly that Doug could not even raise his arms, Gordet clamped his left hand over Doug's mouth and nose, yanking his chin up, and with his right hand sliced the blade deeply across Doug's throat, making certain to sever the carotid arteries behind each ear. Blood spurted high up the wall, gushed over Gordet's green coveralls and into his face, making him blink and wince. Doug's body shivered and twitched, then went still. His hands soaked in Doug's blood, Bordette stalked out of the room and headed down the empty